Welcome to Special Sauce, Sirius Seats podcast about food and life. Every week on Special Sauce, we talk to some of the leading lights of American culture, food folks and non-food folks alike.
There are some great dishes, like, for instance, the garlic soup, which is made with just garlic and water and sage leaves. People need to know about that. I don't mind putting that in every book. You know, it takes 15 minutes to make.
Today, we welcome best-selling cookbook author, New York Times City Kitchen columnist David Tanis. David is the author of the brand new Market Cooking, Recipes and Revelations, Ingredient by Ingredient. Welcome to Special Sauce, David. Wow, like, you wrote really big, heavy book, like even bigger and heavier than Kenji's.
It's fat. Yeah, it is. But it's full of beautiful photographs, mostly.
Okay. Yeah. So that takes up a lot of the space.
It does, yeah.
Oh, got it. So that means you had to write less.
I had to write less, and it's suitable for a doorstop, you know.
It's excellent.
Or if you need to hurt someone.
Right. Like, Kenji, your book probably weighs, what, 7 pounds? Like, Kenji's weighs 9, I think.
Oh, Kenji's is much bigger and more, yeah, and more informative.
I'll tell him you said that.
I mean it.
Yeah, no, it's an awesome book. First of all, tell us about life at the family table growing up, at the Tanis family table, which was in Dayton, Ohio, I believe, right?
Yeah, 20 anni fa. That was a while ago. I still have vivid memories of it.
Yeah, so like who cooked and what were you eating and how did you feel about it?
Mostly my mother cooked.
Okay.
We had a housekeeper who helped a little bit sometimes with certain dishes that she was good with. I mean, that my mother wasn't that great with. My mother made a meatloaf, but it wasn't stellar. It was a good meatloaf.
That's a very politic answer. It wasn't stellar.
But our housekeeper made a great meatloaf, so. But mostly Midwestern fare. I mean, mm-hmm. Basically, and we're talking 50s and 60s. That's like, I don't usually admit to being that old, but...
Join the crowd, man.
But the food then was, I mean, we had frozen vegetables every night. We had vegetables every night, but they were in a box in the freezer, and you just open the box and plunk right. them in a little pot with an inch of water, put on the lid, and let the flame go.
Was dinner a big deal? Like, did your family get together and discuss what everyone did that day? Or was it more like we're in front of the TV or some combination thereof?
Oh, never in front of the TV.
Okay.
And dinner was required. I mean, when we were a small family. When I was growing up, it was just my mother and two sisters.
Mm-hmm.
So we were just four around the table, but, you know, placemats, nice paper napkins, milk in a glass.
Right. Yeah.
Roasted chicken thighs one night, broiled frozen swordfish steaks another night, spaghetti and meat sauce another night, that kind of thing. Except for Jewish holidays, which were more extravagant, you know, and a Friday night was more extravagant because guests would come.
Right.
Not that we were entirely crazy religious, but we definitely observed all the stuff.
Right. And your dad passed away when you were...
When I was a little boy, yeah.
Yeah, me too. My dad died when I was 12.
But you turned out good.
I don't know. You seem to do okay, too. You know, it's like you got to deal with the hand you're dealt.
Yeah, you do.
And when your dad died, I think I read an interview where you said that you then you were eating Friday night dinners at other people's houses.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, mostly it was at other people's houses, but occasionally it was ours.
Was your mother into it? Were you into it sort of secretly?
Yeah, for sure. And she liked to cook, and she was a pretty good cook, and she fed us nightly, you know.
Every night. Yeah. So it was like, and did you ever go out to eat?
Sometimes, not very often.
And where would you go in Dayton?
Ah, well, the place I wanted to go the most was a place called the Tropics.
The Tropics.
Yeah. It was a sort of Polynesian tiki bar with a real bar out front and sort of, you know, all the bamboo and tiki torches in the dining room. My aunt and uncle used to take us there because my uncle was a contractor and he'd done work in the kitchen, so he had a lot of trade to do.
That's awesome. So you got tiki drinks galore. Except they were virgin.
I was maybe 10 years old.
Right.
I used to always get the baby lobster tails because I thought they were absolutely delicious. And my mother would always look at me, urging me to order something a little bit cheaper. I think they cost like $4 or something.
That's awesome. But they were caught locally off the coast of Dayton.
Yes, indeed. Yes.
Did you get interested in cooking at that moment? And how did you start experimenting in your home kitchen?
You know, I was always interested in eating, and that's mm-hmm. for sure. And I think I had a good palate early on. I certainly could tell whose house butter was used in and whose house was using margarine. We were a margarine house.
Got it.
Except for company.
Mm. Right.
I appreciated good cooking, and I, you know, loved to eat. And I'd like to get in the kitchen a little bit. When we were small kids, we weren't really allowed in the kitchen. Didn't want to mess there, would you?
Right. But as a teenager.
So then we would sneak into the kitchen, at odd hours and make things and clean up real good. But as a teenager, then I started dabbling with bread, actually.
Baking bread.
Yeah.
Fascinating. Not because your mother ever baked bread.
No. Uh-uh. A friend gave me a recipe. Actually, I had tasted it at her house. A friend had made, from Craig Claiborne's recipe in the New York Times, something called Cuban bread, which was pretty much like a very nice crusty French loaf.
Right.
You know, when you put the water in the bottom of the oven and
yeah, that they made Cuban sandwiches out.
Yeah. So I first learned how to make that, just pretty much teaching myself, following the recipe. And then I branched out into all kinds of bread baking and pie baking and a lot of bread baking.
Even in high school?
Yeah.
At that point, did you think that maybe it would be your calling?
No.
No. Like, when did that happen?
Probably when I was in college, I guess. I don't even know that I thought of it as my calling, but certainly I was drawn toward it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I was drawn toward professional cooking.
You went to college at a small school in California,
Yes, an obscure little college called Deep Springs College.
That's still around,
it's
right?
Still around, but there
isn't there like 100 students?
No, not even. There are only 25 students usually.
Per class or in total?
Total student body.
That's insane. Yes, that's what I read about it.
They're just about to go co-ed. It's been an all-male institution for 100 years.
And what was that like to go to a school where there were 25 students?
I guess it was intense, but it was pretty wonderful.
Really?
I thought. And I grew to really love the desert because this school sits in the middle of a desert valley 40 miles from anywhere. A sort of an odd place to be, but a kind of a wonderful place to be, really, for a couple of years.
Did you cook there?
Yeah, that's kind of where I used to hang. There were some professional chefs who would cycle through the mess hall, the boarding house, as it is still called. So I would hang out in the kitchen with them and learn things.
And so what did you do when you graduated?
I went up to Washington State and moved in with a bunch of college graduate hippies. And we lived in a great little communal situation in the woods.
Everyone was living in a commune at that time.
And we did a lot of cooking and a lot of gardening. Then I realized I needed to support myself since I had basically just left home and I was out in the world. And was hired by a chef who did work at Deep Springs for a short period. He's opening up a restaurant, an existing restaurant. He was reopening in the San Bernardino Mountains.
Really?
Called Lake Arrowhead.
Right, sure.
Do you know about it?
I do. I spent my senior year of high school in Los Angeles, so I know all about Lake Arrowhead.
Okay, well, there's a restaurant then, and probably still is, a restaurant called The Chalet, which served continental food.
Every community had a restaurant called The Chalet.
Yeah. Well, there it was. The waitresses were all wearing dirndls, but the food was pretty much like Veal Oscar, that sort of thing.
Continental food.
Yeah.
And did you go there as a baker or just as a line cook?
I went there as a baker because my friend the chef knew I liked to bake. So he gave me four index cards, like with various recipes, like cream puffs, cheesecake. And he said, here's the recipes. You're the pastry chef. Go to it.
And did you love it? Like,
oh, yeah. Yeah, completely.
And you're like, this is really cool. Someone's paying me to make cheesecake.
I learned a lot about cheesecake.
What's the most important thing you learned about cheesecake?
Don't cook it too fast.
Got it. And then how did you end up at Chez Panisse?
Oh, through a long, convoluted process. I won't bore you with all the details. I moved up to the Bay Area.
This is the 70s.
This is right after the chalet, when at the end of the season, the entire kitchen got fired, which is kind of normal, I discovered. So I went up to the Bay Area and began to look for work there. Worked in a few restaurants in Oakland and San Francisco. Hung around Chez Panisse. Had friends there. Sort of knew the team there.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't actually start working there until the 80s.
And who was the chef when you first started hanging out? Was it Jeremiah?
Just post-Jeremiah.
Got it.
Yeah.
What was the occasion that they finally did hire you?
Well, it's an interesting story, but not really. But it is kind of, it goes along with the bread baking scheme, because they were at that point baking their bread in-house. And the bread baker, Steve Sullivan.
Who went on to found Acme
Breads. Went on to found Acme Breads, you know, some of the best bread in the world. So he was the baker. He would come in at 5 in the morning and bake all the bread for the upstairs and the downstairs and then get out. It's a very small kitchen. So that the pastry department could take over the area where he did his breads and the rest of the kitchen would start functioning as a kitchen. So he left to get married and I filled in.
Doing bread,
yeah.
This was when Lindsay Shear was doing the desserts?
Mm-hmm.
So you filled in and you must have done reasonably well.
I tried to make myself useful.
You didn't burn the bread.
I didn't burn the bread, and I was always leaning over to the cafe department saying, do you need a hand peeling garlic and that sort of thing? And one thing led to another.
And so then you ended up working for Steve, or?
No. Then I ended up working in the cafe. I went up to the pizza station immediately.
Oh, you did?
Yes, indeed.
Wow. Yeah. I've written a lot about that pizza in my pizza book. So you ended up making pizza. And you ended up staying sort of off and on for a long time.
I eventually became chef in the cafe after Joyce Goldstein left and, you know, went on from there.
What did you like about it and what did you find problematic?
It's a place that you do kind of, people stick around because kind of a great environment. It's a stimulating environment. It's very collaborative. I would go so far as to say it's a fun place to work.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a serious place to work. You're working with really great ingredients, and the caveat is make it good.
Mm-hmm.
And don't stop until it is good.
Right.
And, you know, change the menu in the middle of the night if the dish isn't working, that sort of thing.
Because
we change the menu every day. Sometimes it would take a little longer to get the,
right,
you know, get the dish fine-tuned.
It was collaborative and probably stimulating because there were probably a lot of smart people working in
that kitchen. A lot of smart people, yeah. A lot of smart people and a lot of smart asses. Can I say that on the radio?
Yes, you can.
Good.
It's a podcast.
Well, I mean, I myself included, but a lot of smart people, a lot of very intelligent, smart, beautiful.
Curious
people. And a lot of social interaction, shall we say, with over 100 employees, and both kitchens crammed with cooks. It was always interesting, and you know, as dysfunctional in the way that many families can be, but it doesn't mean it's a bad family.
Right. Right. Lots of ups and downs, I assume. Lots of strong emotions displayed.
All of that, but never the sort of hierarchical screaming chef syndrome, or at least not on a daily basis.
Right.
You know, it was all about community. Still is.
Obviously, you enjoyed it, or else you wouldn't have stayed on and off for 25 years. But I'm interested in the whole thing about on and off, because it's when I talk to other people who work at Chez Panisse, they also talk about the same sort of. It seems like Alice Waters, she encouraged flexible.
Oh, yes, indeed. Yeah, she still does. I mean, it's the idea is if you might need to go to Europe for a few months and learn something, and then you're going to come back and bring something with you, you know. Or maybe you just need to go away for a year.
Right.
But, you know, keep it lively, keep new blood coming in, and also keep the old blood interested. Engaged.
It's not a finely tuned business as a business. It's probably the kitchen may be more finely tuned than the business.
If you go back to the very beginning, it was a shambles, of course, but Alice will tell you today, she'll say, I never was interested in making money. I wanted to support a lot of people. I wanted to have a nice restaurant. I wanted to do something for the community. I wanted to, you know, all of those things. Money being secondary. Didn't want to run the business at a loss. You know, in the first years, of course, it did run at a loss. But now it runs, I'm not privy to the figures right now, but it runs as a, it's a functional business.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
But it still has quirks.
Yes.
And it's not ever going to franchise.
Right. And it's, yeah, people always say, well, Alice, why didn't you open five more Chez Panisses? Yeah. Why isn't there a Chez Panisses in Las Vegas? And people who know her, of course, know that that was never...
That was never part of the plan.
Yeah. Then you got to a place where you were splitting your time between Chez Panisses and Paris?
Yeah, that came at a certain point. Yeah, not so long ago. I left Chez Panisses in the early 90s to mm-hmm. go to New Mexico and open a restaurant there. Stayed there for about 7 years.
Oh, yeah. Chris Bianco always talks about
yeah,
you.
Yeah, we were right across the hall from each other.
Yeah.
Which was, it was great. I mean, I loved being in Santa Fe. It was a great experience. But when that adventure came to an end, moved back to San Francisco, ended up working, guess where?
At Chez Panisses.
Yeah. But this time as the downstairs chef.
Right. We should explain to people that the downstairs is the more formal dining room. Upstairs is the cafe. And so you were the chef at the cafe before you went to New Mexico.
Right. Yeah. The downstairs is more formal and there's a prefix menu that doesn't, you know, no choice menu. And
right.
Upstairs is an a la carte menu.
Right.
But this food is very similar.
Yeah. And so you ended up the chef downstairs.
The interesting way they set up the chef position there is that there are two chefs for the cafe and two chefs for the downstairs restaurant, which means they both chefs share a week in the kitchen, you know, 4 days, in the office 1 day, then they overlap and there's all of this, the more minds, the more ideas. And
right.
And also it means that then one person can take a little time off without the place becoming unstable. So we were doing that downstairs as well. At a certain point, for a while, there was just the chef, you know, it was sort of Jeremiah, it was Paul Bertoli, it was Jean-Pierre, who also came and went and came and went.
Jeremiah is Jeremiah Tower, of yeah. course.
Then at a certain point, it became a two-chef system downstairs as well. Turned out, Jean-Pierre was back for another long stint, and we ended up sharing the kitchen together. He likes to go to France in the summertime. I'd already started, I believe, living in Paris at that point mm-hmm. or spending a lot of time in Paris. I'd moved there, yeah. One thing led to another, and the proposal came, why don't you work half the year, and we'll have Jean-Pierre work half the year.
Jean-Pierre's last name is?
Moulet, Jean-Pierre
right.
Moulet.
Right.
Who was there since almost the very beginning, really, mm-hmm. really talented fellow with, you know, deep roots at Chez Panisses.
So the proposal was, okay, David, you'll take 6 months. Jean-Pierre, you'll take 6 months.
Instead of splitting the week.
Got it.
So we did that for, I don't know, 5 or 6 years, I think. One of those situations of work like hell for 6 months, but then have, you know, time to travel and cook quietly and all that kind of mm-hmm. stuff elsewhere for a while. So
yeah. And then you ended up opening a supper club in Paris, a sort of, it's like a... It's a precursor to a pop-up, right?
Kind of. I mean, it wasn't really back in the dark ages, but it was before pop-ups started happening quite so much. And there were, you know, you would hear about little private supper clubs throughout Paris, and we went to a few. And, you know, sort of coming from a restaurant background, sort of like, why don't we do it?
Right.
And so my partner Randall and I, always worked in the front of the house in restaurants and has, you know, maitre d' and sort of, you know, wine wizard and all of that. So we just, the two of us, in a kind of a beautiful Paris apartment with a big room, one big room.
Right.
And the tiniest kitchen you ever saw, maybe about the size of this table.
Really? For everyone who's not here, this table is probably 4 by 4. Maybe?
Well, if you cut it in half and it was 2 feet wide and it went the other direction in a long counter, then that would be kind of what it was like.
Wow. So, and how many people were you cooking for?
Usually 12 at the table. Sometimes they knew each other. Sometimes they didn't know each other.
And how did you get the word out about it? Just friends of friends? It just sort of spread virally?
Email, yeah. A lot of people were American travelers.
And was it fun?
Yeah, a lot of fun. A lot of fun. Because, well, it's fun to do something illegal.
Let's start there.
No, just kidding. It gave us the opportunity to market a lot more and to buy a lot more food, which is great because the markets in Paris are so fantastic.
Yeah.
We go to a different one every day. If we were charging people to come and eat dinner, we could afford to buy a black truffle or two to serve.
Right.
Whereas if we weren't inviting people that were paying to come to dinner, we would have no truffles. That sort of thing.
Yeah.
But a lot of the food was, you know, very simple, rustic, straightforward fare for the most part, yeah.
And how long did you do this for?
Well, I don't know, off and on. It began with great enthusiasm.
like many things.
About once a week, and then it dropped down to twice a month, and then it dropped down to occasionally, and then I think it dropped down to on demand. But always fun. But if I had my druthers, I'd just rather have friends come over for dinner and not worry about all the business part.
Got it.
Right.
But then at a certain point, what was the thought process behind leaving restaurant cooking?
Well, I'm not saying I've left restaurant cooking, but I was certainly ready to...
At the time.
I was certainly ready to take a break.
Mm-hmm.
I'd already begun writing cookbooks. My first book came out in 2008.
Mm-hmm. That's Figs.
That's Platter of Figs.
Right.
And then another one a couple of years later. And then I started writing for The Times.
So what made you take a break?
I don't know. Did I get fired? I don't think so.
You couldn't get fired from your own supper club.
No. Take a break from, I thought
from
you meant...
Chez Panisse, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Sometimes you know when it's time to move. You know, maybe I was getting old and cranky. I don't think so. But I kind of like to do something different every 10 years anyway.
Right.
And so the last time I did that, I moved to Paris. This time, I moved to New York.
Got it. So let's talk about your new book, Market Cooking, Recipes and Revelations, Love Revelations, Ingredient by Ingredient, and cookbooks in general. You wrote the first book after you left Chez Panisse, or you were still there?
I was still there.
So you're doing double duty, which I've done.
Mm.
It's not so easy.
Mm.
Really hard. I've done it. I wrote the first five books when I had day jobs.
The next time I write a book, I'd like to do it on an island with nothing else to do. But I still haven't figured out how to do that.
So how did you come to write the first cookbook?
An editor approached me one day and put a little bug in my ear, and it sort of started that way. And it took a long time to write because some people are very organized and others are less organized. I think I fall into the second category. I need somebody with a whip.
Right.
And I've come to realize that. So that's one thing to learn.
And did it require any change in your thinking because you were focusing on home cooking? I know Chez Panisse cooking is fairly close to home cooking, but it's not identical.
No, it's not identical. And you don't have somebody to wash the dishes, and you don't have somebody to clean up, and you don't have a prep cook to help you get everything chopped and all of that sort of thing. Although it's always a good idea to finagle a family member into becoming one of those things.
Right.
A family member or two. But I always like to cook at home. I still like to cook at home. Even when I was working at Chez Panisse, I would go home every night and cook a little dinner.
Because, really? You wouldn't eat at the restaurant?
Well, I was all revved up, and I didn't want to stop, you know, and sort of unwind in the middle of the evening because that's when our cooks would have their meal. We had two seatings downstairs. Then the cooks would go sit down and have a meal after the first seating was finished. I would take care of a little business and just generally be my, you know, sort of nervous self. And,
right.
And then I would give the cooks a little chance to sort of let off steam and not have me in their face all the time.
That damn Tannis,
I know,
man.
I know. And so then by 11 o'clock when I got home, I was usually fairly hungry.
Yeah.
Often it was a pasta and a salad. Sometimes it would be a soup, something like that. But
you would actually cook for yourself when
boil
you got
water,
home.
Boil water and make pasta, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. Imagine.
And did you discover that you really like to write, for example, like, or is that something you've had to develop, or?
I knew that I liked to write. I mean, I was an English major in school. I mean, it was a part of me that I let go dormant for a while, but I still wrote pretty good emails, you know,
right.
and that sort of thing, and wrote a brilliant journal.
A brilliant. I was going to say, and I haven't even read it.
I have journals in boxes. I'm going to go back and read them someday.
Uh-huh.
But no, I always liked to write. And so when the opportunity arose, I was really happy to do it.
Yeah. So you wrote one cookbook while you were at Chez Panisse, and you discovered you liked it. And then somebody paid you to write another. You've written four cookbooks now altogether,
This is number four. It's a hideous process. I don't know why anybody would ever want to do it.
So let's talk about that a little bit, because I think people would be interested. Everyone describes it, if not as being hideous, there's another adjective that's equally not positive. So why is it a hideous process for you and so many people?
Well, like so many other things, it's all-consuming.
Mm-hmm.
Deadlines are hideous, really.
Mm-hmm.
And making a deadline can make you a hideous person and all of that sort of thing. But once you get the manuscript written, the work isn't done.
No.
Then it goes into, rewrites and re-rigging and all of that sort of thing. And some things have to get... go longer and some things have to go shorter.
Right.
All of that sort of thing.
If there just weren't editors, it wouldn't be as hideous a process. Of course, maybe the books wouldn't be as good.
The books might not be as good. I've got a pretty damn good editor. And they make really beautiful books at Artisan.
Yeah. Yeah, I wrote a book for Artisan. The Young Man in the Sea, uh-huh. The Dave Pasternak book. And also the other thing that I always notice about books, and I'm writing one now, is that they're never done.
No, not until the very last minute.
It's the worst. That's the worst feeling. It's that you think, every time you think you're done, it's like, oh, no, there's something else you need to do.
Well, I complicate it for myself because I want to cook the food for the book. I don't want somebody else to cook it. I want to be there with the photographer. I mean, I get help cooking because
right.
we're shooting, you know, multiple
sure.
dishes every day. But that's... that's probably 2 weeks of photography thrown in on top of everything else, which is exhausting but fun.
Mm-hmm.
Because you know, I want the photographs to look really edible, and I want them to look real. Mm-hmm. I don't want them to look as if they've been arranged by somebody in any kind of artificial way. Although, of course, you have to use artifice anyway.
Right.
But I want to be involved in the visual process. So I just also butt into the design aspect as
right.
well. And, you know, you want your book to be...
You're kind of a control freak in a quiet way, aren't you, David?
I guess so. Yeah,
right.
I suppose.
All right. You're guilty. So
but,
am I.
But it's true. It takes the first year to get the manuscript finished and the second year to get it edited to the printer and in the shops. It's a long process.
And has your cooking and your writing evolved over the years since you've started? Like, has it changed?
It's hard to say. I think my cooking is getting even simpler than it ever once was, but maybe that's not true. But I still like to spend a lot of time in the kitchen.
Right.
And I don't know if I can be objective about how my writing has changed or not. You know, I don't know about you. I find that I write differently depending upon the weather, depending upon my mood,
yep.
depending upon the subject.
Right.
Sometimes I can write 800 words just flowing, and sometimes it takes a few hours to get 400 words down.
So. Yeah. Yeah. Are you one of these writers that just has to get something down on paper and then you go back and make it good?
I do that, but first I stew a lot.
You stew a lot. It's very important. Stewing is a very important,
I usually stew,
not only
I
cooking.
Usually, I usually stew for a couple of days before I actually sit down and start tapping keys.
How do you come up with the theme? or the structure, because it's very different than writing a menu for a restaurant. A book is a very different animal.
A book is not a dinner party. It's true. But it can be about dinner parties, and that can help define the book. In the case of A Platter of Figs, that was the situation. I actually began basing that book on the dinner parties we had in Paris for the supper club. And so all the recipes in A Platter of Figs are designed for a table of eight people. And so that was a way to sort of express myself with that book. And individual menus, several menus for each season. So I got to address all the sort of seasonal issues, and also the concept of how to make a menu. What goes first, what goes in the middle, and what goes last. But also, how can you achieve it in a home kitchen without killing yourself?
And what about the new book, which is called Market Cooking Recipes and Revelations, Ingredient by Ingredient? What was your thinking behind the organization of that book?
I wanted to take the focus away from menus per se, and focus on the actual ingredients. I also wanted to write a lot about vegetables because I really love vegetables. But the main thing I wanted with this book, well, I wanted to inspire people to cook at home. I wanted to inspire people to go to the market, buy food, and cook it. And for a lot of people, that is a foreign concept. But when, in actual fact, it's the way people have been cooking for eons, right? It's normal. You go to the market, you see what looks good, you take it home and you cook it.
Right.
And maybe you even ask the butcher, how long should I leave this in the oven? You know, or you see, oh my gosh, there are new asparagus. I'm excited. All of that sort of thing. So I wanted to generate that kind of excitement, but also I wanted the book to be inspirational. So if you open a book at any page, you would find something that looks like you really want to eat it, and then find a recipe that tells you it's not very hard to make.
Right. The book is beautiful, and I want to get into not being hard to make, because what I noticed is that, first of all, every recipe takes up one page.
Pretty much, yeah.
I mean, maybe.
Yeah. No, I think you're right, yeah.
And which I think is interesting, and yet you never write about how fast you can get this on the table. It's an interesting dichotomy.
Of course, there are instructions for bake for 1 hour, but it doesn't right. It doesn't say at the top of the page, this is a 30-minute meal. It may say this is a quick meal that I make all the time, but honestly, how can you tell somebody that it's a 30-minute meal? Some people cook quickly, some people work slowly, but even if you're a quick worker, I think 30 minutes is a little bit tight. If you want to enjoy the process.
And in order to do so, they have to lose track of time.
The process, to me, is quite important. That's why I understand, but that's why I wouldn't buy a meal that was sent to me in a box with all the pieces chopped up and ready to go. Mainly, I like to pick out my own green beans.
Right.
And I like to chop my own green beans up.
Right.
I want to chop the garlic just before I use it. There are a lot of little things like that. So much of cooking is intuitive.
Right.
I'll tell you, I never take a teaspoon of salt and measure it before I put it in something. I know how much salt to pinch and how much I usually put. And that's part of cooking, too. I think all of that is enjoyable.
In this particular book, but probably all your books, there is a simplicity, sort of an elegance to all of the recipes. You know, when I read them, I was like, oh, I'd like to make this. This seems very possible.
Yeah, possible. I wanted definitely to have possible recipes, especially in this book. And some of the recipes are written in standard recipe format, and they're scattered through a number of recipes that are just written in narrative prose, because it's basically a recipe is often just a description of what you do.
Right.
And sometimes you can say it in three sentences and people will know exactly what to do.
Right. And recipes are, after all, in the end, stories.
Exactly.
And you hope they don't have too much tension.
No, yeah.
But there's always some tension in recipes, too. Talk about your life now. So you do the Times column.
I do the Times column every week for the last almost 7 years.
Wow.
For a person who has trouble with deadlines... That's saying something.
Man, Sam Sifton must be on your case. And what's that like? What's it like having a weekly deadline?
It's
you can say it. It's okay.
Oh, it's hell.
And so have you discovered that you actually like, in a way that you, whether it's that you like the deadline or that you need the deadline.
Mm-hmm. Hate it. Need it.
And so you've been doing this for 7 years.
Indeed.
50 columns a year? Or yeah,
at least 50 columns. And often there are multiple recipes in a column, so.
Wow.
So, yeah. So there's a... There's an archive of recipes now.
Yeah, and do you use some of those recipes in your books or as the inspiration for some of the recipes in the book?
It goes both ways, actually.
Uh-huh.
I might find a new variation on a recipe from one of the books that I want. It doesn't have to just stay there and be quiet all the time. It can be told again in a slightly different way, and I think that's legitimate. And I also use some of the material from the paper in the cookbooks as well. It's a little bit hard to sort of draw a line between where one starts and then and the other one ends, but it often tends to be a variation on something that I've done. But there are actually a few recipes in Market Cooking that have appeared in other books of mine.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's legitimate too, because in a sort of way, if you only had one book that I had written, and it was this one, I would want some of that other information to mm-hmm. be in this book, too.
Got it.
There are some great dishes, like, for instance, the garlic soup, which is made with just garlic and water and sage leaves. People need to know about that. I don't mind putting that in every book. You know, it takes 15 takes 15 minutes to make.
Got it. So that leads me to my next question, which is, if there were three recipes that you would tell people to start making when they bought the book, what would they be? Garlic soup would be one of them.
It's a very surprising soup. It doesn't taste garlicky, or not. It doesn't taste garlicky in an unpleasant way.
Because when you roast garlic, it gets sweeter. And
even when you simmer it, in this case, it's chopped garlic that's simmered in water with a little salt, a few sage leaves, and pretty much nothing else. In about 15 minutes, you have a broth that is as tasty as chicken broth.
Wow.
And
that's amazing.
Yeah. And if you put...
That's alchemy.
Yeah. But it's not new. It's like, you know, that is something they've been doing in the south of France forever and ever when you didn't have any money.
Right.
But it's good even if you do have a little money.
Yeah. So I like that. So garlic soup, give us two more.
Something that people might not do so much is cook turnips. And I love turnips, and I think other people should love turnips too.
You're not ashamed of that?
No, I don't know. I'm a turnip eater.
Okay.
There are a couple of recipes in the book for turnips. One is cooking sort of small turnips with their green tops. Well, first you cook the turnips, and then you put the tops in and let them wilt around, and it's all ready in 10 minutes, and it's outrageously good. And what have you used? You've used a little bit of butter, a little bit of water, a little bit of salt.
Right.
And you depend upon the vegetable to supply the rest of the flavor.
All right. One more.
From my New Mexico days, I'm still quite enamored of all things.
Chili.
Yeah. And so there's a recipe for red chili burrito. It's basically beef chuck or brisket that's simmered in a sauce that's simply made of ground pureed dried red chilies.
Right.
And it's sensational. People should know that one, too, I think.
That's good. But you know what's funny? When I read the book and when I was doing all my research for this interview, you're not a snob. You're not like you have to make your own tortilla for this burrito. It's like it would be good.
Mm-hmm.
But the discussions I've had with lots of other chefs, including Alice Waters sometimes. Mm-hmm. It's like, you know, if it's not organic, I don't want to eat it. And, you know, you should make your own bread. You should make your own this. It's like, really? You know, and you don't seem to be a slave to that kind of orthodoxy.
I'm not a slave to it. I think people should do the best they can. I'm mostly encouraging people to enjoy cooking.
Right.
And then once they begin to enjoy, they can make some other choices. But everyone doesn't have time to make their own tortillas, so you stop by and get some from somebody that makes good tortillas.
Right.
And there's no shame in it. There's no shame in using frozen peas.
Right.
There's you know, there shouldn't be any shame anyway.
Right.
Is what I think. Am I pro organic? Absolutely.
Sure.
Absolutely.
But that's different. You've been quoted in other interviews as saying you would much rather, it's not even that important that the food that you make comes out perfectly, that it's the act of cooking for somebody and then people sharing the food that you made is actually more important and is better than, as you've said, than either a mediocre or a bad restaurant meal.
Well, I think so. And more affordable.
Are you still curious? Are you still exploring new things to cook, new cuisines? Like, what gets you excited these days?
It's a funny thing to say, but I really get excited going to the market and to any kind of market anywhere. So
could be an Asian market, could be...
I live not very far from Chinatown. And when I'm sort of feeling a little blue, I'd go down to Chinatown. You know, it takes me 10 minutes to walk there and walk around the market stands and all. I feel better in a minute. Seriously.
That's like a form of therapy for you.
Yeah, yeah. And to be in a foreign country or a country that I know and just head into the market, and you go in Italy and you're looking at artichokes and it's like, oh, I forgot about artichokes. These are so beautiful.
Right.
Or I have been enjoying doing some Indian cooking and I'd like to learn a lot more about it. Various Asian cuisines I dabble in, but I don't necessarily feel that I'm an expert. But it's fun to cook with foods that you didn't grow up with. It's fun not to eat a hamburger.
I'll second that.
But it's fun to eat a hamburger, too.
Yeah, we love hamburgers, Serious Eats. And do you also love to, when you find a new ingredient, like, is that, like, a big turn on for you? It's like, wow, like, this is a cherimoya. Like, what do I do? What can I do with that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That must be one of the pleasures you get from the markets.
Well, it is. But it's interesting because everybody's on a sort of a different path. And some people have already discovered cherimoyas, and you might not have discovered them yet. So
right.
It's like, it's always nice. Just like, oh, I never ate a walnut like that before.
Yeah.
What kind of walnut is that?
Yeah. It sounds like you still have, there's a lot of things you want to explore. Would you say there are many books left in your future?
I expect there might be. I would like to do a baking book someday.
Your roots.
Yeah. But I'd also maybe just like to write a poem or a novelette.
Right.
Or maybe a short story.
Got it.
Or a postcard.
You mentioned that you haven't really closed the door totally on returning to a restaurant kitchen.
No, I haven't. I mean, I still participate in a lot of restaurant events, you know, some of the charity events, but, you know, doing a little popping up here and there, which, and anytime I get to spend time in a restaurant kitchen, I always enjoy it.
All right, so now it's time for the special sauce all-you-can-answer buffet. I don't want you to get nervous, David. Take your time. Who's at your Last Supper, no family allowed? It can be anybody. It could be artists, poets.
When you say Last Supper, am I dying the next
day? No, you're not dying. It's just poor figure of speech.
No, this is a concept, and that's one thing that's always been curious to me. If I knew I was going to die the next day, I might not be so hungry.
Right. Yeah, exactly. So this is a figure of speech in this case. It's just like, who would you like to break bread with? I mean, you cooked for Stephen Sondheim, I read.
I did, yeah. I'd like to have him for dinner again.
All right, so there's one. I like that.
And then the whole crew that goes along with him. He came to our house in Paris one time, and there was Frank Rich and Alex Witchell, who are great company at the table as well. And then there's James Lapine. But I don't see these people very often, but when I do, I really always enjoy it.
Yeah. So those are all theater people.
Yeah.
And any other walk of life that could find your way to your table?
Yeah. Well, I met a lot of people in Argentina and Uruguay, and I've spent a little bit of time there, and people are great. So I'd like to have all of them come to my house.
You'd like
dinner.
To have all, this is a big, now it's become a big dinner.
I mean, it's not the entire country of Argentina but it's a core group of people that I know in Uruguay and Buenos Aires that I would love to, and some, and they can all bring friends.
Yeah.
So it will be a big dinner party.
Okay, that's good. So what are you eating?
Oh, for this dinner?
Yeah.
Oh, geez. If I have Argentines and Uruguayans, then I have to have meat.
Okay.
It wouldn't fly.
Right.
But they do meat the best.
Right.
So I would feel a little intimidated.
Like Francis Malman style
meat?
Yeah,
I would like to have him at dinner as well.
Francis Malman, the famous Argentinian open fire chef.
Wonderful man.
Right.
Really, really wonderful man. I'm happy to know him.
Okay.
And then I can put him in charge of the meat.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So, now you're starting to think the way I want you to think. So you got Francis Malman, you got Stephen Sondheim, and Frank Rich, Alex Witchell. I mean, this is a good group.
Could you come too?
Yeah. All right. Yeah, I'll be there.
All right, bring a friend.
All right, I'll bring my wife. That would be awesome. So it's just been declared David Tanis Day. What is happening all over the world?
Everybody's eating beans.
Everybody's eating beans.
Yeah. Whole world over. Dried beans cooked.
That's it. So they're not going to work. They're just eating.
No, you get a day off to eat beans.
You get it. I like this. I like this. All right. Well, thank you so much for sharing your special sauce with us, David Tanis. Check out David's superb work in any of his 4 cookbooks or in his City Kitchen column in the New York Times, or, of course, his brand new book, which is called Market Cooking, Recipes and Revelations. We didn't even get into the revelations. Ingredient by ingredient.
I would
really
say there's only a subtle revelation in every recipe.
Okay. That's great. Thank you so much. And we'll see you next time, Serious
Pleasure.
Eaters.